Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson. And today I have on the program authors Kay Williams and Jerry Williams Lawrence, sister duo, to talk about the novel One Last Dance, It's Never Too Late to Fall in Love, published by Calliope Press. So this book was actually started by their dad, Marto Williams, at age 92 and finished by the two of them after his passing at age 95. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about all of these three very special people. Marto had a distinguished 73-year career as a journalist and author, for which he won an Ohioan Library Award. After he completed most of the first draft of One Last Dance, he asked his daughters, Kay and Jerry, to finish the book if he could not. He died a few weeks later, and his daughters went on to honor his wishes. Kay Williams is a professional actress who has played leading roles in theater, radio, television, and films. She has worked behind the scenes as an assistant producer with an award-winning independent filmmaker in New York City. Recently, she co-authored the new mystery novel, Butcher of Dreams, with Eileen Wyman, and I had the chance to actually talk with Kay recently on the program. Jerry Williams Lawrence is a writer and editor. She currently tutors high school and college students in composition. One Last Dance is her first book. As a teacher of high school honor students in literature and composition, she was actively involved in curriculum development for gifted students and was publications advisor for both the school newspaper and the literary magazine. In conjunction with this novel, Kay and Jerry have developed a multimedia program which focuses on their father's philosophy of living life to its fullest no matter what one's age. This program, called Keep Dancing, continues to be well received by libraries, social organizations, senior centers, and civic associations. And I definitely want to find out more about this program. Sounds very, very interesting. So more about Kay, Jerry, Marto, and their projects can be found at calliopepress.com. So I'm just so happy to have both Kay and Jerry on the program today. Welcome, ladies.
Well, thank you, Anita. I'm glad to be back.
Great, Kay.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Jerry. So, you know, it truly is amazing that your father started this book at age 92 and basically worked on it until his passing at 95. So why was it that this novel was of such importance to him?
I think he had a lot to say about the process of aging and what it means to be in your 90s, and the body is failing, but in your mind and your heart and your spirit, you still want everything, you know, just like the way you did when you were 16 or 40 or 70. He had thought he was going to write a book about his newspaper career. He'd had a 44-year a newspaper career, and he wanted it to be a novel because he'd never tried a novel before.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd actually started that one, but then he met a woman. Our mom had died several years before, and he was pretty lonely. This particular woman had seen him interviewed on television for his first book that he started at 88, called Maud, about his mother, who lived to be 110.
Wow.
She had seen him interviewed on TV. She went into the bookstore to get her copy of Maud and found that it hadn't been autographed. So she decided to track him down, and she found he was staying for the summer at Jerry's house. So she came over to get her copy of Maud signed. Well, Dad discovered that he knew her.
Oh, wow.
That she had actually worked at the Columbus Dispatch part of the time that he had been working there. He was on the fourth floor in the newsroom, and she worked as an executive secretary on the fifth floor. And they had just kind of known each other in passing, probably just waved at one another, maybe chatted briefly at the parties. But so he was very glad, of course, to see someone from the Dispatch, and he autographed her book. He gave her a kiss goodbye because he was leaving the next week for Florida, his Florida home. And she said later that kiss goodbye became a kiss hello. He went to Florida. She called him. I didn't even know this was going on. I would call from New York probably once a day to say hi to him. And mm-hmm. I began to discover as I tried to reach him, the line was so busy. Dad was not a big talker, you know. So I went an hour later. Still, the line was busy. So once I even got so worried, I asked the neighbor to come over and check.
Oh, no.
Well, I found out that this woman had been calling him, and he said, well, she's quite a talker.
Apparently.
But it did alleviate his loneliness. And when he came back to Ohio, they really became an item. He would go over there every day, and they would get together and go to dances, et cetera. So one thing led to another, and they began to share living quarters at her place in Ohio and Dad's place in Florida. And so he began to think, hey, this could have a lot of humor in it and a lot of, pathos.
Challenges.
And challenges. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jerry, go on about the challenges.
Well, you know, the thing is that 95 or 92, you have developed some rather rigid ways, and Dad had been on his own probably for several years at that point, and of course, she had been living on her loan for a number of years, and, of course, she favored her little poodle. So anyway, they definitely had some ups and downs, and I think he could see the humor in it as well as the frustration, and I think... he thought there was enough material there to fill a book.
Well, so then, Jerry, how much of this book is actually fiction compared to what your dad actually went through?
I think the truth of it is sort of the catalyst of it, but the Dixie is not really just this one woman that he met, you know, that who they began sharing living quarters. It's partly our mom. It's partly an aunt.
Mm.
It's partly... someone he worked with, and I think all the characters take on nuances of other people that he's actually had contact with. I think there's a kernel of truth, but it isn't solely truth,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
The little dog just becomes, you know, the little Lhasa Apso instead of a poodle, and the things that happen there aren't just things that necessarily happen, but, you know, it became a work of fiction.
But basically his message, I guess, is what kind of resonates the same through his life and into this novel.
Yes, and I think, too, the idea that people at an older age continue to have the same desires, the same needs, the same enthusiasms that everyone has. People sometimes think older people sit in the corner, or they should be sitting in the corner, and they're just withering away.
Right.
And I think he was able to project the idea that everyone at every age wants to have a relationship, they want to enjoy life, they want to express themselves and do it.
You know, a lot of times there is a stereotype as well of the more mature person or elderly that very stuck in their ways and don't really want to change. And I know that your father really broke through this type of stereotype in this novel and really in his life.
Well, I think
he really did. In fact, people, somebody commented to us, someone who reads widely, and she said, you know, the characters in this book are not caricatures. They are truly people. And I thought that was a high compliment. And, of course, it does reflect Dad's character.
Sure, Kate?
Well, I think it takes a lot of courage at any age, you know, to get involved with another person that's an unknown, and you don't know if your heart is going to be broken or if it will work out, and especially at that advanced age, it takes a lot of
Well, everything is unsettled. I mean, for Dad, it wasn't a happy ending as it was in the book. The health problems intervened, and it really didn't become quite the satisfying relationship it could have been, but still, there were moments.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But the thing is, I think if you are a writer, you use the elements, it kind of kicks you into writing it, and it becomes a catalyst, and then you go into your fiction mode, and it doesn't have to be like real life. It can be like Dad's happy ending, you can manipulate that. I think it was very satisfying to him to have a happy ending. He didn't. He wrote the first draft all but the ending, but he told us a couple of weeks before he died he did want a happy ending, and I think it was because he could formulate the ending the way he wanted it to happen.
Last time in his life there, do you think he considered that he had a happy ending? You know what I mean? Like, do you think that he was at peace, Kay, with life at that point?
Well, he had been on really a big up since the publication of his first book, Maud, I think, and he was healthier then.
When did that come out?
After our mom died, we felt we were worried about him, Jerry and I.
Mm.
And we thought that he might not make it. It had been a long illness for her. So we said, why don't you write down what you know? And you've always been telling us all these stories about our grandma who lived to be 110 and how it was, you know, at the turn of the century, practically, just after the turn of the century, how it was growing up, you know, on the banks of Rush Creek when everything was done so laboriously by hand. And so he thought he would write about 50 pages for the family so they would really know where everyone came from and the hardships it was to get to Ohio, which was considered the Wild West in 1854.
Sure was.
And to show how his mother's life really paralleled all the big historical things that happened in the U.S., you know, the two World Wars, the Great Depression, that kind of thing. So he intended it to be 50 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a writer's group I belong to here in New York City, so I read a couple, you know, 10 pages here and there of it, and I could tell they were really excited about it. Mm-hmm. So they got involved, and they kept hearing everything and said, well, we want to know more about this. We didn't understand this. We were never farmers. What do you mean by this? Well, we want some more anecdotes about the family. We want to feel, you know, their personalities more, that kind of thing. So it did keep him busy, and it grew and grew. And Jerry and I both thought, hey, this is interesting, but we may be prejudiced, you know, because it's our family.
Mm-hmm.
And so it grew to 335 pages. And by the time it was out, I think Dad was, what, 90, Jerry, 91?
He was early 90, he was able to be pretty vibrant and active at that point. So
he went on tour.
We took him to bookstores for book signings, radio stations for interviews, TV stations.
Oh, my gosh.
Several places in Florida and in Ohio, and I don't know how many bookstores he appeared in, but many, many, many.
What
and
an
also
accomplishment.
Retirement centers.
Mm.
It was quite a heady experience for someone who thought he had retired at 65, although he had kept writing independently.
No kidding. What an inspiration.
And his health was good then. You know, it continued until he got pneumonia that kept coming back on him. And after Mom's death, we discovered that he had had asthma. And sitting in the newsroom for 25 years at the Dispatch with all those people smoking probably had damaged his lungs. And I think there was a weakness in his lungs. So as he reached 92 or 93?
I think 93 when he had his hip replacement. I think maybe that was a real shock for him, but he still bounced back from that. But I think the biggest blow for him and for us was almost overnight. He'd had macular degeneration, and he was going to a retina specialist.
Mm-hmm.
But almost overnight, he'd had bleeding behind the retina, and he could not see to read any longer. And that was, I think, such a blow. I think it was demoralizing. He was in the middle of One Last Dance at that point. I mean, he had all but the last 11 chapters in the first draft. He didn't know it was 11 chapters, but that's actually what it became.
Okay.
And so Kay suggested that he get a little tape recorder and try to, organize it in his head and try to get his ideas down on tape. And that's what he did, all but for that last chapter that he said he wanted to talk it over with us, but we were going to work on that for the ending when Kay flew home.
So the vision of this book, he did tell you then, even though it wasn't completely finished, he knew how he wanted this book to go.
Well, he'd been
yes.
studying it, I think, whether it would have a happy ending or a sad ending or an in-between ending. And I know he was up in New York at a book signing for his second book, which was his children's book, and he'd been interviewed by the New York Observer there. And he said then, you know, that I think he was thinking of a more downbeat type of it. But as he thought about it and thought about it, I think it was probably just a month or so before he died. Isn't that when he told us, Jerry, that he wanted that happy ending? I think it was very
cool. Well, yes, I think he had been sort of leaning that way, and I think you had the phone conversation with him, and he was saying, well, you know, he decided that he wanted to have that happy ending. And I think, I don't know if you've read the book or not, but
mm-hmm.
there are some laugh-out-loud funny places, and Dad had a great sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because of his sense of humor and his, I think his love of story, you know, he wanted to keep that upbeat feeling to it, even though the book does deal with realistic situations
yes.
also.
Yes.
Also, he wanted to prepare the way for his sequel. He's
oh.
like, well,
oh.
the way this ends, it's going to open a whole new can of worms, so people are going to want another book to find out what happens to this group now,
oh.
because two more people have joined Dixie and Morgan.
Oh, he
yes,
was sneaky.
The mysterious stranger is becoming part of the fold.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about One Last Dance and the actual the story in this novel, because we have Morgan, Dixie, the Whispering Pines Retirement Center, and this mysterious stranger, and I think you're alluding to Tony, right?
Yes.
Yes, so tell us about the story, actually, and these characters.
Well, you know, the reader is introduced to this sort of a ghost voice in italics, I would think two or three times before Morgan and Dixie have a chance to come in contact, and you're not sure exactly, but you know he's a young kid, and he's having some hard times, and he doesn't have a very good attitude.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
and gradually you begin to see that this person is going to be impinging upon Morgan and Dixie's life, and I think one reader suggested that she became so worried about the threat that she had to look at the end to make sure that Morgan and Dixie were okay. Oh, but anyway, gradually, you know, it evolves, and I don't know how much we should give away, Kay.
Oh, not too much.
If you have anything to add, go ahead. I'll stop here in case I get too carried away.
Well, we just like the fact that people get worried when they have this kind of like voice over from this menacing person.
Yes.
People in my writers group even said, I don't know, who is this person? Someone from Morgan's past. Morgan, as Dixie comes to find out when he moves in with her, and of course the two move in together only for economic reasons they both maintain, but Morgan is kind of a sly fox, a bit
mm-hmm.
of a rogue, and he has
secrets.
Actually, more frivolous intentions there.
Okay.
But after he moves in, Dixie begins to find out more and more about secrets in his past.
Mm-hmm.
And she does a little searching through one of the dresser drawers where he has his clothes at one time. And then the two of them come home from a movie. They've been out in a movie, and actually, things have kind of settled down for the two of them. Some of the abrasive moments of when they first moved in together and kind of fought and bickered a lot have gone by the wayside. They're getting more accustomed to each other. They walk in the house and find that it has been broken into and absolutely trashed.
Mm.
There is a smell of vomit. There is a smell of booze. Someone has gotten into his good scotch. Her plants have been turned over. The dirt is all spilled over the floor. The back door is open.
Pig on the wall.
Right, you pig is written in red on the wall.
Oh, no.
And who would have done this? And, of course, the thing that really concerns Dixie almost as much as anything is that her precious little dog, Jiggs, is missing.
Oh, no.
So she says, finally, to him, they do find Jiggs. I think I shouldn't have given that away. Don't worry about that. But Dixie says to him, as she thinks it over, nothing like this ever happened to me before you moved in. And they both kind of secretly wonder, although she comes right out and tells them, does it have to do with your past?
Okay, yeah. And that's where the past comes back, maybe. That was one of the interesting, I think, themes that your father wanted to include in this book, you know, secrets and the past coming back at some point later in your life.
Well, and of course, by that age, you have a lot of baggage.
Yeah.
You know, when he moves in, he's 89, and Dixie is 79. She has a lot of baggage, too, and we come to find out that she's kept a few secrets from him that she broods about and worries about and is afraid that, you know, at first he'll walk out if he knows this and that, and then, you know, so it's one of those kind of, each of them is walking kind of a tight rope throughout this until they finally are very truthful in there, and it all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
But he did want to show what baggage older people carry, how many kind of incarnations they've had since they reached this point, and he also wanted it to be an intergenerational book because he really disliked the idea, you know, of, well, like people moving into a retirement center where everyone is, you know, over 60 or whatever. He liked the idea of that the older generation should teach the younger by example, and the younger generation should look up to the older for wisdom and advice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all three characters, the main characters, Dixie, Morgan, Tony, all evolve. I mean, they all have some change that creates a, you know, this sort of electricity and satisfying ending and really underlines the importance of love and relationships in everyone's life.
And I imagine, you know, maybe someone would think that this novel is really geared for the more mature reading audience, but this is actually, like you said, Kay, it's very multi-generational. So really, this is probably a great book for a lot of different age groups. Was that kind of your dad's vision? Did he ever talk about that?
Well, I think it was part of his philosophy that, I mean, naturally he wanted to do Dixie and Morgan's problems with a sense of humor. His meister said he had a great sense of humor, so he wanted to have that and what could have been a very dismal, discouraging story, as a lot of people have said. He dealt with the issues of aging honestly and with humor and thoughtfulness, and so the book is really uplifting and encouraging. But he did, I think the book does appeal to, I'm not sure, the really younger kids, but anyone who thinks about their parents and is worried about them. We've had people contact us, I'm in my 50s, I read the book, I loved it, I am passing, and it's made me go out and, I'm doing all belly dancing now, I'm doing all of these things to be active, and I passed it along to my parents, hoping it would inject a little romance into their lives.
Uh-huh.
And I think it would be, you know, book discussion groups are the greatest thing around now.
Yes.
It would be great for a book discussion group, mother and daughter, where the daughter is, say, 40 and the mother is 60 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does give people who don't want to think about it, I think most of us are in that position when we're younger, who think we'll be immortal forever and we don't want to think about what it's like to age.
Mm-hmm.
But as other people have pointed out, it does give people a blueprint, an idea of what it's like to get older, and it does, I think, come back into their lives at that point in time. Like I say, you're middle age, you've gotten into a rut. Hey, if they can do it, have the courage to do this, and, you know, in their 80s and 90s, I got to have the courage to do such and such in my 40s.
Mm.
So I think it does, has inspired a lot of people. I haven't really talked, have you talked to anyone who is, say, a college age, Jerry, about who's read One Last Dance?
Well, I guess not, but I, I have some colleagues who work with high school students who felt that it was intergenerational, that it would appeal to younger people too, because certainly Tony, as the juvenile delinquent, go either way, and the threat that he poses, you know, is certainly something that probably many families have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I've not talked with anybody who's younger.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
It would be. I think it would be a great fit, really, for any age. I see what you're saying, Kay, with maybe the 40-60, you know, the 40-year-old and the 60 or the baby boomer, you know, that kind of age group. But I think this is just a wonderful book with just such a universal message that it would be great.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Amazon recently introduced Kindle, a revolutionary ebook reader that has outpaced expectations in sales. This is a sign that more people are turning to the digital delivery system of books as the practice of digital downloads spread. Let us help you get your printed book or ebook available for instant purchase on Amazon Kindle. You set your own price and collect 35% of list price on each sale. We will upload your book and optimize it for the best performance on Kindle. Please go to readerviews.com and link on the Services for Authors tab on the top menu bar. There you will find a link for more information on how we can upload your book for Kindle viewing today.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm speaking with Kay Williams and Jerry Williams Lawrence, authors of One Last Dance, It's Never Too Late to Fall in Love. You can find out more about One Last Dance through the website CalliopePress.com.
I think that a lot of people over 60, they feel like kind of like the lost generation.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is about youth and beauty and the thinking is like, well, after if you're 30, you aren't in the game anymore.
Yeah, right.
Now it's like after 60, what do you know? You
mm-hmm.
know.
That's interesting. Well, there's so much that has changed in society, in the world, so quickly over the last, say, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, that there kind of is a bit of a split in the generations like that.
I think that, you know, the people really like to see themselves as leading characters in a book. This one book discussion group I talked with in Florida, actually it happened, I think they must have chosen the book, not knowing this, I don't know, but it was Port Charlotte, Florida Library, and actually that's where Dad's home was, in Port Charlotte. And I found out by doing a Google that they were going to be discussing One Last Dance, so I called them and I offered them our CD of Keep Dancing and said I'd be glad to participate by phone. Well, they decided they wanted to do a phone-in, that they had a speakerphone and could do it. So I called in, and it was very interesting as each person, there were three or four people who came up to the phone and just talked to me what it meant to read the book to them. And I think there were not only the general thing that you like in novels, the characters were people that they cared about, the character development was fantastic, they said, but they really, a couple of them mentioned they really loved the fact that the characters actually had a romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That so many young people think, oh, well, old folks.
They're not into romance.
And she said that she has a significant other now. She had met someone when she was in her late 60s, which was a good friend, and then it turned to something else. And so just reading One Last Dance, you know, kind of reinforced what she was experiencing with her good friend. Also, she said it gave her the courage to maybe try to write the story of her life. She'd been thinking of it.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, her feeling was, well, if your dad can do it at 92, I'm in my 70s, why not give it a try?
Mm-hmm.
And another one mentioned about Dixie, that she really had met a lot of people like Dixie, and one thing she pointed out was waiting to hear the illness that Dixie had. I'm not going to go into that more, but it's something, again, that you'll kind of have to wait to see what it is she's worried about and as far as her own health. And I had the feeling this woman was actually talking about that she had gone through the same thing, as we find out later what Dixie went through. She'd gone through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you think of a book about older people, you think about, like, my father's walk through Alzheimer's or, you know, something so dismal. And so many people love that note of encouragement and inspiration that the ending brings with it. But all the way through, they fight their battles, they fight each other, and they come through.
Mm-hmm. Full
They're
circle.
Feisty.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I'd like to know from both of you, actually, and Jerry, you can start here, whether it was a difficult process for you to finish this book, you know, with your dad's passing and then carrying on the requests that he had. Was it difficult? Was it a challenge for you to get through?
Well, I think it ended up being 8 years in the making, finally, because after the year after Dad died, we really couldn't think about looking at the manuscript. It was so painful.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we had the computer, the word processor chapters, but then he had also, you know, recorded several tapes of material that needed to be transcribed before we could actually see what was on it. Kay, finally, I think about a year afterwards, started with the transcription.
Mm.
And once that was there, that was when we could actually make some choices, decisions, and look through it and see what all was there. And then I think it became a very rather intricate long-term process needed to get, you know, there were some certain things that were changed for effect, and maybe a character might have been added, or, you know, the order of events would be changed somewhat. And then after there was, you know, the next rough draft, then it became something that Kay could read to her writer's group, and then she would send chapters to me, and I would make suggestions and email all my suggestions, and we would get on the phone. And so anyway, it became a very lengthy process. How many drafts did we have sitting around the house, Kate?
Oh, I don't know. I still haven't shredded some of them. One of us had to keep track of it, so I was elected to do that. And Jerry could be ruthless. She's quite an editor. You know, we need to get rid of all that. It's so boring. I fell asleep, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, no.
I would do it. Then I'd wake up at 4 in the morning or 2 in the morning and say, no, what have I done? All it needs is to be tightened, you know, and a little more attention brought in. So I would go out and I would tighten the whole thing and give it to her for one last pass. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, we
Before
did have
we
some
start...
arguments about some things. But anyway, I know the first time I said, oh, I about fell asleep reading that. So we ended up having a little set to, but not bad.
Yes.
Of course, we wanted to include as much of Dad's material as possible and to, you know, and to rework it. And there were things that he wanted in that he had kind of said, well, if you can fit this in, do it. Or if we can fit this in, we'll do it. But, you know, like any rough draft, you have pages and pages of stuff you aren't quite sure if you can make it work or not.
Yes.
And but I thought, oh, well, I'll just give this a try and see if it's going to work. I must say, before we started revisions, we did start with a kind of plan, which I think was wise.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Dad had written, as I say, the whole plot is totally his and most of the characters. And some of it is was in finished form, and other parts were needed more revision. But he had written from the omniscient or bird's eye view. And we decided we really needed to be tight in the heads of the three main characters, Morgan, Dixie, and Tony, so that people could really get in there and see why they behave so badly sometimes.
Right.
And feel a little more sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
I think that really helped with Dixie and Morgan.
Right,
and
right. And Tony, too. Mm-hmm. And to get in and see when they said one thing and what they were actually thinking, maybe totally the opposite, could provide a lot more humor, you know. So,
and insight.
So I think that was good that we did that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it's such an interesting project because it's really was a family project, and I'm really interested to know how through this collaboration process the two of you as sisters, whether your relationship changed at all through working on this book.
I don't think it did at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we have been very close and very simpatico, I guess, in terms of our relationship and our interests and our tastes and our focuses. And so, therefore, I think it was a natural for the most part. Didn't you feel, Kay?
Yes, I did.
And so, I mean, if we disagreed on something, Kay is the great compromiser, but usually she would come back with a little adjustment that would work, you
mm-hmm.
know. And so we ended up, I think, not really feeling upset with each other about it at all. She's wonderful to work with.
Well, I felt the same, you know, about Jerry, because we had this kind of relationship that, like when we were kids growing up, something could happen, like around the table or relatives could be there. We would just look at one another, and we would go into bursts of laughter. We'd be rolling on the floor or something, because we could kind of read each other's mind about what we were thinking at
mm-hmm.
that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we both had been so close to Dad, and we just knew, you know, about his sense of humor and his teasing quality and his wonderful generosity. And we knew what we wanted to keep and what we wanted to expand on. And I really loved Jerry's editorial suggestions. She's a brilliant editor.
Mm.
And so it was really good to have someone come up with, you know, some creative input, and to have someone also, the same person, be able to say, nope, I think that's too much or whatever, because I felt that she at times was a little more objective than I was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, too, the writers group was really instrumental. Jigs the dog became much more of a character because one of Kay's writers group loved the little dog. Every time the little dog was in a group of the 10 pages Kay was reading to them, she would get ecstatic about Jigs.
That's
and so
great.
Kay's reaction was, gee, if he's that interesting, maybe we ought to give him a bigger role.
That's great. You know, I'd like to know also from both of you in your own unique perspective, the influence your father and his career, you know, he was a journalist and an author, and both of you have forays into the literary world. What his specific influence was on each of you? Jerry, you can start.
Okay. Well, I think growing up in high school when I had to write an essay or something, he would usually I would have him read it, or I would say, oh, I don't know how to start this. And he always had this great advice. He said, you know, it really doesn't matter where you start. Start writing. That could be your conclusion before, or it could be the body. You don't know, but just start writing, because once you get pen to paper, your brain begins to make associations and you're going. And I have found that to be so true. In almost anything that has been difficult to write, if you do that, you do come up with an end product, and you can go back. You let it cool off a day or two, and you edit it, and it comes out like, okay, this is good. You know, this is working. And so that was one of the biggest things.
Mm.
And, of course, and I use that. I think I learned more about writing from Dad than I did from any teacher. And then I use that same process when I work with students, you know, and also wordiness as a newsman.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of any unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say it simply if you can. You don't use $100 words if you can find a 50-cent word.
That's great.
So anyway, just things like that are probably just elements of style by Strunk and White rules, that be vivid, be specific, be precise, and of course we love words too. I think we probably have inherited that interest in words and stories.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I guess I feel the influence that I attribute. I always told the students that I just wanted to give them the advice my dad gave me.
Oh, that's great. How about you, Kay?
Well, my dad always he would try to look over my themes if I asked him to.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give me like a good verb that was punchier than what I had or something. And I remember in one English class, the teacher chose my theme to read aloud. And, of course, all the kids there knew that Dad was at the newspaper in town. This is when we lived in Kenton, so I bet your dad helped you with that. So that I always kind of got that, but he only gave me the word, you know, I would say. I did the writing. But I was always so entranced with the newspaper there in the small town Ohio where he started his career at age 21. And of course, I was young. I would go up and I would see these old-fashioned presses just roaring and see the metal type that they would drop down into this fire and, you know, just below the floor. And it was just so exotic and fun to be there. So I decided I was going to be a member of the newspaper community. I was going to be a paper girl.
At a time when that was unheard of.
A paper girl?
A paper girl in town. I did it for a year, and Jerry used to go with me when I went to collect the money because everyone suddenly disappeared then. And then when Dad was down in Columbus at the Dispatch, he knew the reviewer quite well, so I started getting some freelance jobs, reviewing, you know, movies and some theater, some plays in town. And so that was interesting, but I decided I didn't want to be a newspaper person because of the deadlines. And I had really thought, I have got to try my hand at acting. I just got to know if I can make it or not. So I kind of veered off in that direction. Actually, I feel now maybe I should have stuck with writing because, in a way, it's so much more fulfilling because you get to be all the characters that you write. And in acting, you know, you're really stuck with your looks, your age, et cetera. You play that type that they type you as. But with writing, you have so many more possibilities for creativity.
Right, right. Well, now you're on to the writing career.
That's right. Got two sequels in mind now.
Two sequels.
Right. And some film scripts. I tell Jerry she's got to write the film script for One Last Dance and then go on to the sequel. And
The screenplay. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So who do you see playing?
Butcher of Dreams.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we're seeing Jack Nicholson and Shirley MacLaine as the two lead characters.
Oh, great. What a great combination. You know, I have to also mention that One Last Dance actually has won a few awards. In 2006, won the Independent Publishers Award for Best Regional Fiction, and then was one of five finalists in the National Reader's Choice Awards for 2005, which I believe was sponsored by the Romance Writers of America. So how do you think Marta would have felt about this great, great reception of this novel?
Both he and I have talked about how he would have reacted to know that he was probably the one male author represented among the romance writers of America. He would have been tickled. He liked women. And so it would have been quite an experience had he been able to realize that.
That's sweet. That's
also, the Akron Beacon Journal, I think, had it on its list of the best novels of 2005
for
new writers, which was quite a nice recognition also. So I think he would be very, very happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we felt his presence so strongly when we were working on this book, kind of like he was looking over our shoulders, tapping us on the shoulder, and, you know, don't do that, or whatever.
Did he really feel that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, I mean, I'm sure it's magical thinking or whatever, he must somewhere know that we kept our promise, it's out there, and his instinct was right on.
Oh.
It has hit a nerve.
Yes. You know, Kay, I think
you know, it seems that everybody who reads it has a lot of enthusiasm for it. It's just a matter of having people interested enough to sit down to try it. And I think it's growing. You know, I think more and more people seem to be still interested after, you know, its initial publication.
Right, right. Absolutely. I know, Kay, you had considered that this novel was your father's magnum opus.
I think so. I mean, I think fiction is, you know, Maud is excellent, and it's being used by some college history classes to put a human face on history as a supplemental text in the class.
Really?
But I think fiction is so much more difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad just had a superb first draft, so anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think
of the English language. You know, he had the greatest vocabulary. I don't know if anybody could have beat him at Scrabble.
That's great.
But, you know, when Dad was starting to write Maud, he said, oh, I used to have such a big vocabulary. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. This was, you know, his first book after being in the newspaper.
Oh, wow.
So we sent him a thesaurus, and it all came back magically.
Really?
Or not magically, through sheer dint of hard work.
Hard work.
Sounds like such a fascinating. You know, our time is kind of coming to an end here, and I really wanted to mention Keep Dancing. So tell us briefly, Kay, what Keep Dancing is all about.
Well, when I was very busy with some personal problems, Jerry put together a fabulous program that is based on the story behind the story of how One Last Dance came about, the fact behind the fiction of One Last Dance, and about the career of our dad and our role in finishing the book. And we delivered it just as a live performance. We also enacted Morgan and Dixie's violent meeting at the beginning of the book,
mm-hmm.
so people had a flavor of the actual book itself. Well, then Jerry had the great idea of putting photographs with our what we were reading. In other words, it became a PowerPoint program that the pictures are projected on this huge screen as we deliver, you know, our script.
Mm-hmm.
And it's proved to be wonderfully effective. And that's what
and
we
see. And Dad is really there with us because, you know, you see him in various parts of his life.
At various ages.
Through the photos. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fantastic. So where are you putting this on? Where can we see Keep Dancing?
Well, we've done it about, 60 times so far. It started out just as sort of a local tribute to Dad at the retirement center where he had lived for a short time. And then other people, bookstores and other people started, you know, sponsoring it sort of and asking us, and so we started putting out feelers, and this next week I guess we have five programs?
Yeah.
I think we do. Anyway,
really?
Kate's flying in on Monday, and we have two programs on Tuesday. Wednesday we have one down in the Cincinnati area. Thursday I think there's nothing, but Friday then we've got, no, Thursday we've got a book discussion, and then at Barnes & Noble, and then Friday we've got another one down in the Cincinnati area. So anyway, we've got, it
busy.
Seems like every month we've got four or five, six programs to
wow.
Travel and present.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are in Ohio,
because okay.
I could stay, you know, with Jerry. I've done one here, I'm hoping to get more, for a Brooklyn library.
Oh, fantastic. So are those dates on your website, CalliopePress.com?
Yes.
Oh, great. Great. Well, it's just been wonderful talking with you ladies today. We're kind of coming to an end here, but I want to wrap up by offering you the last few minutes to each share any final thoughts. Did you want to start, Jerry?
Well, I guess I always think that Midwest Book Review, the quote that we use is so uplifting. They called One Last Dance a sweeping, elegant romance.
Mm-hmm.
One Last Dance celebrates the importance of living in the moment and never giving up.
Mm-hmm.
Emotion and hope surge from the pages in this novel that leaves the reader feeling invigorated and enthusiastic about life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, due to Dad.
Very well put. Thank you, Jerry. How about you, Kay?
Well, I guess I would just like to conclude with Dad. His last word, if that's okay.
Sure.
He once told an interviewer life is for living, no matter what our age or condition. If we can sing, we should sing. If we can write, we should write. We should always be in search of a new experience, always be ready to commit ourselves to a new interest. And he lived this philosophy right up to the day of his death, February 3rd, 2001.
2001. Mm-hmm. Wonderful final words. Thanks so much, ladies. It's just been such a pleasure talking with you. Best to you, best with One Last Dance, and I hope to have both of you back on the program again, Kay for the third time and Jerry for the second. So thanks so much, ladies.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thank you.
All right. All right, listeners, there we go. I've been talking with Kay Williams and Jerry Williams Lawrence, both authors of their father's book, One Last Dance, It's Never Too Late to Fall in Love, and their father, Mardo Williams, published out by Calliope Press. And I believe that this book is available through local and online booksellers. Actually, I'm very sure that it is, as well as through their website, CallliopePress.com. So thank you once again for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.